This is the Nichols Patrick Current Federal Tax Developments for the week of April the 24th, 2017. Current federal tax developments are brought to you by Nichols Patrick CPE, a division of the Lascalzo Institute, and your state society of CPAs. This week, we're going to start taking a look at a few interesting items that have come up tax-wise. We'll discuss the issue of the IRS examining agent that the tax court slapped down for not considering granting late rollover relief to a taxpayer who ended up with a problem in that regard. We have a new list of automatic accounting method change procedures that have been made available by the IRS under a revenue procedure that they adopted a couple of years back. We now have our second year of the brand new comprehensive list coming out. We have a taxpayer that attempted to be a real estate professional who had another job, and we ran into a little problem of the simple math of hours. And finally, we're going to take a look at an issue the IRS had not previously decided, or I should say the tax court hadn't previously looked at, that dealt with prepaid forward, variable prepaid forward contracts, and whether you can actually modify one of those and still retain the tax benefits that were claimed under the contract. Well, we're coming up on, as always, CPE season right now. And certainly here in Arizona, I'm going to be doing a few days coming up in June. So I wanted to remind you, because we're now looking around, and those of you in Arizona know that we always kind of look around and sign up now, because in Arizona, our discount dates come here by the end of May. And so what we end up with here is I've got a few days coming up you might want to sign up for. June 7th, I will be presenting the tax update at the Financial Planning Conference. Now, this will be done as both a live and a webcast, be the first time the webcast Financial Planning Conference on June 7th, so you can get the full day there. Then I'll have 2 days worth of live CPE in Phoenix and webcast on June 12th and 13th. I'll be doing real estate partnerships, get in, get out, get taxed on June the 12th. And June the 13th, I'll be doing the pair of four-hour courses, one on Arizona ethics, the other on the Arizona taxation and tax update. Then I will go ahead and travel down to Tucson. Now, on June 14th, I have scheduled in Tucson assisting the survivors of the decedent's estate. That particular session will not be webcast, so you need to actually come to the session in Tucson if you want to be part of that broadcast. But if you're in Arizona, you're in Arizona Society, remember, you know, consider when you're looking at your courses for this year, some of those we offer here at Nichols Patrick, and what you could sign up for. So be aware of that. If you're in other states, check your catalog for Lascalzo and Nichols Patrick's courses. We have those ready and available for sign up now as well. Now we're going to move on to start looking at our developments for this week. And we're going to start by looking at some special rules that deal with retirement plan rollovers. They're complicated. Our clients get confused about them easily. And if other things are happening in their lives, you may find a problem that they took money out of the account and we finally discover that they made a mistake when we get around to preparing the return. You know how that works. You pull out, they get all their stuff in front of you. They pull out a 1099-R and you start asking them, what is this? And the answer becomes not good because they took it out and they ended up putting it into a regular checking account, or for whatever reason, they didn't get things done within 60 days. But the good news is that we can help the taxpayers in problems like this. We have a lot of relief provisions that are available for us. The IRS was granted a number of years ago the right to waive late rollover relief, and we were able to apply for private letter rulings to get that done. Last year, the IRS added a new provision in Revenue Procedure 2016-47 that even greatly expanded those cases where you don't even need to ask for a private letter ruling, but you can automatically get things corrected. So we have all of these neat things with plan rollovers, but things go wrong. And what we're going to look at here is a tax court case this week where things went wrong. And we're going to look at how the IRS dealt with it and how the tax court felt about how the IRS dealt with the case. Our case in this case is the case of Trimmer versus Commissioner. This is 148 TC number 14. As always, the fact that that is a published tax court case means the court hadn't really dealt with this issue before. It came out on April the 20th. In this case, the taxpayer suffered from a major depressive disorder. He essentially had retired from the New York Police Department He thought he had a job set up to go to. So he submitted his retirement papers. He thought he had a job set up to go to. It turns out that job fell through and he was unable to find other work. Now, this was stressful for him because his son was going to college. He was expecting to use that money to pay for the job. So he fell into a deep depression. During this time, what happened was the New York Police Department paid out to him money that represented, you know, a portion of his retirement funds that was an eligible rollover distribution. Unfortunately, the taxpayer left the check sitting on his dresser for over a month. And then when he finally did decide to do something with it, he put it into a regular checking account. Okay, we have a few problems here. The IRS finally noticed the problem. What actually happened was his preparer noticed the problem, as I mentioned, our usual problem, the 1099-R comes out. So the preparer notices that we have a problem. The preparer told him, okay, you need to put this in an IRA. For reasons that aren't really discussed, the preparer, we're not told why the preparer did not actually, you know, was not actually able to work this out and tell him get a private letter ruling. It may have been the preparer wasn't aware of those rules. It may have been that the preparer simply, you know, didn't know about those things. Could be the preparer just decided it wasn't that big a deal. We could just do this. But for whatever reason, we didn't ask for a private letter ruling. The IRS noticed the problem because they got the 5498 that told them when the money had come in. They got information about when it gone out. Obviously been more than 60 days. They issued a CP2000. In response to the CP2000, the taxpayer sent a letter. And his letter explained that he's contesting. So in response to CP2000, he's contesting the amount to be owed. He said he retired from his job and, you know, essentially he couldn't manage his affairs. He received his check deposited into the bank in, you know, in July of 2011. The money remained in that account till August 2012 when it was switched to an IRA. That's when his preparer told him to move it over. He indicated there was no deception. They hadn't touched the money, hadn't spent the money. They've been paying taxes, have never had a problem. No harm done, he said, except to me, because he was receiving only a 0.25% interest. And he switched the money to an IRA before he was notified by the IRS. The agent who got the letter, well, first said, you know, we'll contact you back in 45 days, that standard issue letter. And then 3 days after that, though, he got a letter stating that, you know, nope, sorry. It had to be done within 60 days. You didn't do it within 60 days. Therefore, you owe the tax. Oh, by the way, if you disagree with this holding, you know, you can write again. Obviously, the taxpayer didn't write again because he basically had put his case out. So he filed eventually a tax court petition. In this case, the tax court took a look at the IRS. Now, the IRS's position was that until Revenue Procedure 2016-47 was issued last year, which was well after the case, you know, these situations took place, that agents had no authority to grant relief if it was asked for during an exam. The only method of getting relief was to go the private letter ruling route or to meet the very limited conditions, which involved clear error of a financial institution, which did not qualify in this case, for automatic relief. He didn't meet automatic relief. He hadn't asked for private letter ruling. Therefore, he could not ask for relief on exam. The tax court wasn't so sure. The tax court pointed out, they said, first thing is there's nothing explicitly in Revenue Procedure 2003-16 that said you couldn't ask for relief on exam. It told you how to ask for private letter ruling relief, but it never said you couldn't ask for an exam. The court pointed out the code that authorized the IRS to provide for this for a hardship, you know, exception did not have any language in it that prevented the service from offering this relief in exam. And as the court noted, the IRS clearly, with the revenue procedure they issued last year, believes they have that authority. The court also found, looking at that ruling, there was nothing clear about it except that it modified the original ruling. And the court also kind of tripped the IRS somewhat on their own language, noted that while the automatic provisions had an effective date, the provision that's saying an agent could give relief simply was treated as a modification of the original 2003 revenue ruling. That was effective, and the court took the position that modification just simply explained what already existed. Then the court found that the agent had clearly violated his, had essentially violated and abused discretion by not granting relief in this case. The court found this was an obvious case where relief should have been granted. Okay, let's go on now to the next little thing we have in place here. So our second topic of the day, in essence, well, as we said, whoops, went to the wrong slide. Always hate when I do that, for those of you watching there. Here we go. Let's talk about accounting methods now. For those who aren't aware, generally, an accounting method is what some of you will call just a timing issue, right? Accounting method implicates when we recognize income or when we recognize an expense, but not how much we recognize. So, obvious example, if we capitalize a piece of equipment that is a five-year asset, we'll recover that over the five-year period, right? We'll get a portion of that every year. If instead we were to write that off as currently deductible, so it didn't have to be capitalized, we'd get that all in the current year. The amount we deduct will be the same over the five-year period. However, when we deduct it will be different. Now, a lot of accountants love that word, and they love to say, oh, well, this is just a timing issue. It's no big deal. For taxes, it's a big deal. Under Section 446, you must have the IRS's permission to change your accounting method. That is the timing of recognition. If you're using one timing method and you decide to switch to another method of reporting, both of which may be allowed. In fact, even if your current method's not allowed and the new method is required under the law, you still have to have the IRS's permission. That's why we filed the 3115. What's nice about, to some extent, though, is that the IRS has published, and now every year these days, updates a list of automatic change approvals, things that you can just ask for when you file the return, and you will get the right to change your accounting method. So all of that is helpful, right? It's one of those things that we have to remember. So again, just timing, not necessarily means no big deal. It is a deal, but we can get the fix. What has happened this week is the IRS has now yet again updated that list of automatic method changes. Revenue Procedure 2017-30, issued on April 19th, gave us the brand new comprehensive list of changes. If you're in the middle of doing a change right now, you want to review the changes at the end of the document. Some things were added, some things were taken away from the list of automatic changes. Some changes were made in what you need to do to get an automatic change, so you want to review that. It also has special transition rules because effectively this takes effect for any Form 3115 filed on or after April 19th for a year of change ending on or after August 31st, 2016. That would include calendar year 2016 returns that you may be preparing, that you put on extension and you're now sending in the 3115 with the extended return. The IRS recognizes that we can't necessarily turn on a dime here. So they say, first thing, if you've been applying for a non-automatic change, those usually have to apply for early in the year, but now you notice there's an automatic method, the IRS will allow you to switch over to this method, you know, basically as long as you give intent to change, notice of intent to change to the IRS by the later of May 19th of 2017, which is essentially 1 month after this ruling is issued, or the date on which you actually received the ruling, whether it granted or denied you the right to change your method. Obviously, because of the risk you could be denied, most of the times we're going to want to change to the automatic method, assuming that we can get automatic relief. Now, to do this, if you do this, you notify your contact person at the IRS who's involved in this, and then you come back and you file the 3115 as appropriate. So if you're still waiting for approval for one for 16, basically you'd now attach this to your 16 return. If you were prospectively looking for relief in 17 or a year that hasn't yet ended, then you'll attach it to the return that comes forward. They also have provisions in there to discuss what happens if you had an automatic change, but you're now looking to switch back. You know, you now discovered that the automatic change is gone, that you can't do it. If you had properly filed the original 3115 before that date, right? And essentially, you know, it can no longer be granted. You can make the change under the automatic change procedures. If you didn't file the date when it can no longer be made on the automatic change procedures, you may file 3115 request to consent to change the method of accounting under the non-automatic change procedures for your last tax year's ending before April 19th, 2017, on or before the due date of the return. In essence, if you were planning for this to be an automatic change, and it turns out it can't be because you no longer qualify, they're not going to say, well, you had to ask for that, you know, last year. You had to ask for it earlier, you're past the due date. We're going to give you essentially extra time to make this change. So could be useful, something that's helpful. On to our next topic for this week. And now we're going to go on to something that comes up regularly here. We're going to talk about the real estate professional rules. We all are aware real estate professional status grants significant benefits. Generally, rental real estate losses or rental real estate income or loss is automatically considered income or loss from passive activity. If you're a real estate professional, let's say, and you may have 30 rental properties, that could mean that you have a lot of carryover passive losses. The real estate industry said, well, this is unfair because if you've got all these and you're into real estate, this is really part of your business. This isn't an investment, which is what you're trying to get after under your original rules. So the Congress said, okay, we'll let you do that. You'll test under the regular rules if you're a real estate pro. But Congress said, you know, this was meant to be limited to people that are really full-time real estate professionals. We do not want to open this up to everybody. So Congress strictly limits who can qualify as a real estate professional. And to qualify as a real estate professional, you have to meet one of, you have to basically have a specific number of hours actively participating in real estate activity. If you are, it's either got to be at least 750 hours, but if it's more, it has to be at least 1 hour more than what you participated in your non-real estate activities that you materially participate in during the year. So because of that, it becomes, you know, a little, you know, it's one of those things that Congress said, we didn't mean for this to allow everybody to easily qualify. We want somebody to qualify who's really actually a full-time professional. And that means at least 150 hours. Because if, you know, if you're retired and you got one rental and you're spending 10 hours on it, we're not going to let you be a pro, even though you did all of your activities there. And the flip side of that is, you know, we also want to say that, you know, if you're, you know, if you are the CEO of a large public company, the fact that you may spend 150 hours on real estate is no big deal if you're spending 2,500 hours, you know, running a company. So the more hour rule in real estate is what we're really going to talk about here, because we've seen a lot of cases recently, and that means the service is looking at it, where they've been concerned with people who are trying to claim they're a real estate pro, but they're actually involved in a business full-time in an activity, an employee full-time in another business that is not qualified for real estate. Or remember, there's two rules here. Even if it's a real estate business, if you're not at least a 5% owner, those hours also don't qualify for you. So we have the problem, if somebody's working full-time, you know, how are they going to be able to show that they're a real estate pro? And reality is, it's going to be darn difficult because the math is your problem at this point. And that math problem came up and bit the taxpayer in the case of Penley versus Commissioner. TC Memo 2017-65 was issued on April the 17th. This taxpayer had a full-time job, which we agree he worked 2,195 hours on during the year in question. Now, he also claimed to be a real estate professional, and he, per his log, per his calendar, I should say, he claimed to have 2,520 hours in that activity. Now, before the tax court even got started with looking at his calendar, they did a bit of math. If you add those two sets of hours together, and you consider that, well, it was a leap year, so it's, you know, 2012, there's one extra day to work. But if you took that leap year and you divided his total hours that he had that year by the number of hours in the year, or by the number of days in the year, he would have had to average nearly 13 hours a day, either on his regular job or in his real estate. Now, if you think about that, I realize we all just finished working a lot of hours in tax season. But, and you know, and this is considered a job if you're here in public accounting and you're in tax. During tax season, it's considered a job that has, you know, lots of hours. And you might meet that test during like the last few weeks of tax season. Some of you, I'm sure, did. But anybody here really think you could sustain that through every day of the year? That you could work 7 days a week, nearly 13 hours a day, that would make sense? Remember, if he takes a day off, the numbers go even bigger for other days. So the court was highly skeptical to get started. Now again, not impossible. Maybe he's a super workaholic. But now the problem becomes with the court skeptical, they didn't find his calendar credible. They noted that he always started on an even hour, ended on an even hour. The number of hours in a day was always an even number. You know, the court found that some of the claimed hours just seemed way excessive for what he claimed to have done. So the court simply decided he wasn't credible. First thing is, it would be difficult to believe somebody's working 13 hours a day every day. And if you're going to claim something like that, you better have excellent records and excellent backup and some other ways of confirming that you're really that crazy that you would work that many hours. And unfortunately for this taxpayer, he just didn't have that information. The court found him not credible. Now let's go to our final case for the week, because this one is going to bring up an issue that a lot of us here, especially in small accounting firms, run into from time to time. You have a successful entrepreneur, and he gets a huge concentration of wealth in his business. Now, for those of us in small firms, this sometimes occurs when the client, even if the client's acquired by an outside, a lot of times they're acquired. So they sell the business, but they do so in a way where they do a stock for stock exchange. So they didn't pay tax when they sold the business, but now they've got almost all their wealth now is tied up in a particular stock in a company. Or perhaps if this is your type of clientele, you have a client who's successful and who takes the company public. That was the case in the case we're going to talk about here. But suddenly, again, they're holding all of this and 99% of their wealth is all in one company. And especially if you go public, one startup public company that's highly risky. Well, you know, financial planner, you don't have to be very much a financial planner to realize that that's a risky strategy from a financial planning investment standpoint, because if that company goes down, everything goes down with you. So a financial planner is going to say immediately, we want to diversify if we can. But the problem is, you know, I have almost no basis in my startup company. In this case, literally, they assume zero because you might as well. It was so small, it was irrelevant. By the way, the company in question is one you may have heard of, Monster.com, the job site. This was a gentleman involved in founding that. And, you know, so they want to diversify. Well, there are some ways you could do it. Congress limited these back a few years ago with Section 1259. Where you couldn't just basically agree to sell the stock 5 years later at a set price. Rather, you could, however, the Congress decided, and the IRS agrees, that you could use something called a variable prepaid forward contract, which is an option that's blessed by the IRS for doing this. By blessed, I mean they'll accept it as deferring the sale. A variable prepaid contract, unlike saying I'm going to deliver you the 1,000 shares at today's price 5 years from today, rather, we're going to say, I'm going to deliver you shares that will vary on that date. It could be as many as this or as few as something else. So there's a range of shares we're going to have to deliver. It'll depend on the value of the shares at that date. I can deliver them to you in cash. So I could pay cash instead to close out the contract. But I've already pledged the shares that are the max. So their pledge are being held. But then I could also at any point close out the contract. So at any point during that time period, I could decide to close it out, you know, deliver the shares or pay the cash and get out of the contract. And that's what the gentleman did in this case. He had this Monster.com shares. Again, he was one of the founders, assumed basis, as the court says, is zero because it was close enough for this to work. He basically had very little basis in this and he took over. So in this case, which we're going to talk about here today, the case in question that we're looking at here is the case of the estate of McKelvey, because he happened to pass away during this time period. So he had had this variable prepaid futures contract. When we got to the end of the period, now again, we're coming up on the delivery date. As we're coming up on that date, he didn't want to have it triggered at that date. Now he dies shortly thereafter. Not sure the history of this, but it's conceivable that he and the others knew that, you know, he was, you know, we had all these things happening. So he wanted it delayed until after his passing. So he did that. You know, he's going to deliver his shares after his passing. So he pays the two parties. He had two different parties he'd entered these contracts with. He pays them money. I mean, they're large banks. He pays them money, and they agree to extend it for a period of time. So his delivery date gets pushed forward. Now, the IRS said, wait, you can't do that. If you do that, that amounts to closing out the contract, exchanging one contract for another. That's a taxable exchange, and you got to pay tax on that. Well, the tax court disagreed. The court said, number one, there was no property here. What do I mean by that? Under the contract, he got cash when he entered the contract. That's right. After that point, though, the only thing that existed for him was an obligation to deliver shares. Those obligation to deliver shares existed, and that's all. He had no property, had obligations. So changing the contract could not be an exchange of property. And that's what has to happen for a sale to occur under Section 1001. The IRS then had a backup position under Section 1259, that provision Congress had enacted to keep you from sanguine to sell the shares 5 years out at a set price. They said, well, this is one of those deemed sales that 1259 covers. The tax court disagreed there as well. This is merely a modification to a contract. It's still the same type of contract. It's a contract you already told us you got taxed under the open transaction doctrine. We don't close out that contract because we don't know what the basis that's going to be given up, the basis of the property to be given up is until we close out the contract. And that was specifically not covered by 1259. And IRS, you agreed that it wasn't covered in Revenue Ruling 2003-7, which blessed these transactions. So effectively, you can modify a variable future, you can modify a variable prepaid forward contract, get that correctly, and you can change the payment date by putting more money in, and that will allow you to exchange, to defer the date on which the recognition will occur. It's going to cost you money because the other party wants to be compensated for the risk, but it does mean that doing that does not trigger automatic and immediate taxation. You know, if you're in that situation, could be useful in the right situation. And it was a published case, so hadn't been decided by the courts before now. Well, as I said, we finished tax season, so now's the time to take a look at signing up for your continuing education courses. Almost all of our state societies now have your signups available online in addition to the traditional print catalogs. You might want to consider going to your state society right now and planning out what you're going to be taking for this year. You can go ahead and sign up on almost all of them today. As I say, we offer a bunch of courses. There are a number of other organizations that offer courses through the state societies. So if you want to get signed up for your 8-hour live courses, now is the time to go ahead and do so. And I hope to see you at some of the upcoming courses that we'll be presenting at. This has been the Current Federal Tax Developments for the week of April the 24th, 2017. You can catch our updates during the week online at our website, currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com. Also, that website, you can download a PDF that has the articles with all of today's topics that you can find on the weekly update page. If you have any questions or comments, you can send them to me, edzollers@currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com. You also can follow me on Twitter. You can go at the @edzollers link on Twitter, basically follow me there, and I will post up as I post things to the website, so you'll find out as things happen. Well, go ahead, enjoy your post-tax season time period, and we look forward to seeing you next week and in the future on the Federal Tax Developments.